all across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. From our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Good morning and welcome to Up North News Radio. It is nice to have you along as we take another look back at 2023 and some of our favorite interviews, some of our favorite topics, and things that we've learned along the course of the past year. And we did a very special hour in May. It started with Ruth Conniff of the Wisconsin Examiner and the Progressive Magazine previously, and a book that she'd written a little over a year ago now called Milked. And it was all about her experience in Mexico, getting to meet the families of migrant farm workers who took a chance to come across the border without documentation and work on Wisconsin dairy farms. We're not just talking about a handful of people here. We're basically saying that the dairy industry would collapse in Wisconsin if it weren't for the many, many undocumented workers who are on Wisconsin dairy farms now. It's part of a rural economy that is dependent not just upon a good rural infrastructure, roads, broadband, schools, access to healthcare, but the people who are getting the work done on the farms as well, and the farm families who need them, accept them, and have even traveled to Mexico to meet up with some of their family. It all started with a conversation with Ruth Conniff and went on to include a farmer and a person who served as a translator and were featured in Ruth's book as well. So here's that conversation about migrant farm labor in the Wisconsin dairy farm industry and Ruth Conniff's book, Milked. We have a special hour planned. Folks have been hearing me say quite literally for months now how much I was looking forward to having Ruth Conniff back on the program to talk about her book, Milked. We had her on the program, I think, late last summer, early last fall, actually in the Madison studio, and she'd brought a copy of the book in. We were talking primarily about the Wisconsin Examiner and a few other matters, and then I jumped into the book and probably have recommended it more than anything else I have in some time. If you want to understand where Wisconsin is right now from the standpoint of the dairy industry, the immigration issue, the labor shortage, you look at this book, and it's not just about the issues. It's not just about the policy, but the real people behind it. And so we'll be talking to Ruth. We'll be talking to John Rose now, dairy farmer. We'll be talking to Mercedes Falk, who is quite literally a bridge between cultures here in Wisconsin. That's all coming up in just a sec. But first, just a little bit of housekeeping before we do that. And if you can't listen to us live, you can either listen back on demand at the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us, or you can subscribe to the show as a podcast. All of our shows here, each individual hour is broken down into a podcast episode that you can listen to one at a time or subscribe at Apple, Spotify, all the places that you normally do. And of course, Up North News is a separate entity from Civic Media, which you'll find at upnorthnewswi.com, which is not a far cry from another digital media site for Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Examiner. And it is Ruth Conniff's role as Wisconsin Examiner editor-in-chief that we've spoken with her previously, but are now going to join her as the author of Milked, this amazing book. Ruth, thanks so much for being back here. It's nice to see you again.
Yeah, nice to see you, Pat. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And for folks that are watching the video feed, they already are seeing our two guests here, John Rosenau, who is a dairy farmer for Wamedy, who was featured prominently in the book, along with Mercedes Falk, the executive director of Bridges Puentes. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for being here today as well.
Morning.
This was quite a labor, Ruth. And again, being in the news business, you were no stranger to these issues, but you got the real up close and personal view of these things in, what was it, like early 2017, when you didn't decide to uproot the family. Maybe somebody else made that decision, but the family was up. Let's go passive voice. The family was uprooted and moved to Mexico. Take us from there into the idea that what all you were seeing would make for a possibly really good book.
Well, first of all, yes, I do take responsibility for uprooting my family. we decided, actually, as a group, the kids and my husband and I, to move to Mexico shortly after Donald Trump took office for a year. And it seemed like a great time to get out of the country, honestly. It was also just a wonderful experience for our family. The kids became fluent in Spanish. They went to schools in Oaxaca, Mexico, and Southern Mexico, which is a gorgeous place. And we lived there for a calendar year. And it was right when we were leaving that I read a newspaper article. It was produced by Wisconsin Watch. Alex Hall was the reporter. And she described a family from Mexico who was packing up their truck to move home. And that was the first time that I had ever read the statistic that 80% of the labor on dairy farms in Western Wisconsin is performed by immigrants, mostly undocumented, mostly from Mexico. And I thought, wow, 80% of the dairy industry in Wisconsin is dependent on these immigrants. I don't think a lot of people know that. So I contacted the reporter. And when we got down to Mexico, she put me in touch with her sources. And I went to this little town in Veracruz and found that same family, found Luisa Tepole and her family and the truck that they had driven all the way home, and interviewed them and learned their story, which is a classic story of circular migration from Mexico. Mexican workers have been coming to work in agriculture in this country for many generations. There was the Bracero program during World War II that brought people over to follow the crops, harvest crops. And they moved into the dairy industry in Wisconsin relatively recently, which John and Mercedes can talk about more. But really, in the last couple of decades, there has been this be under pressure to get big or get out. As you know, we're losing farms in Wisconsin at a rapid rate. We were the number one state in the union for farm bankruptcy for the last several years. And so the farms that have made it have had to grow. And in growing, many of them hired employees for the first time after being all family operations, and had a very hard time finding American workers, and found Mexican workers who had been working in Christmas tree farms around John Rosenau's farm, moved over and began working in dairy, and then became really the mainstay, the labor force that's keeping our dairy industry going. So I learned from Luisa that she and her family had always not had an American dream, but a Mexican dream. They had wanted to move back to Mexico, had been putting money into building a house there. And later in 2019, I went with John and Mercedes on a trip that they take every year to visit the families of the workers on Wisconsin dairy farms, where Mercedes does a lot of translating and where John employs people, visiting these families who are building homes and businesses. And that link between the two communities, rural communities in Wisconsin and rural communities in Mexico, I found just absolutely fascinating.
The book is called Milked, and Ruth had set up the issue for us that led to her doing the book. John, we'll turn to you next as a farmer who was watching the trend of, you know, farming in Wisconsin and across the nation, going back to, who was Jimmy Carter's secretary? Was it Earl Butz? Was he the one that said, you know, get big or get out? Or was
that Nixon's?
Oh, that was Nixon's secretary. Yes. Anyway, John, you'd seen these trends all along. As you were watching trends in dairy, can you kind of describe what led to the decision that, you know, a lot of farm families aren't having six kids like my wife's family or 10 kids or whatever. And, you know, these farms got to get bigger and we got to find the labor someplace.
We struggled at first. We tried something different for dairy farming. We expanded in 1990, which was kind of the beginning of the expansion thing. And so we hired a lot of women, and that worked really well for a while, but they eventually dropped off by the wayside, and I couldn't find anybody else that would work. I'd go to a farm supply store, and people there were getting paid minimum wage, offer them more money, but had no success. And talked to a friend of mine over in Minnesota, Ron Durst, and he suggested I look in the back of Horse Dairyman. So there was a ad for Amigos Incorporated, and so I contacted them and hired my first Mexican. His name was Manuel. He came and milked 54 days straight, didn't want a day off, worked 10 hours a day. And I thought, my gosh, here's somebody that works just like I do. So I hired two more after Manuel left. And today we have 13 of our 20 employees are from Mexico, and mainly two or three families. My biggest problem that used to be was labor, now is something that's my biggest asset.
That's amazing. And, you know, Mercedes, can we take this to a kind of a human level in that we talk about labor, and we, you know, labor is like a, you know, numbers on a spreadsheet. But John hinted at what makes this labor special is the work ethic, which is very similar to what, again, a lot of farm families have. Farming is not easy. And so, Mercedes, talk about how you came to be involved in this and what it is that you saw when you first started meeting these Mexican laborers and realizing this wasn't just a job. This was something about, you know, benefiting their family back home.
Yes. So John kind of mentioned a little bit about how the folks that came up from Mexico that started working share this same agrarian lifestyle. And they really find working on a farm to be something meaningful and a dignified job. And so I happen to be a neighbor of John's, about 7 miles down the road here in Wamondi. And he was looking for somebody to take over when Sean Duvall, who co-founded Puentes Bridges with him, was retiring. And so he asked me if I was interested, and I definitely was incredibly interested, but I knew that I had a lot to learn as far as the language and culture. And John said, you get the language, no problem. You have the biggest heart, and that's what matters. And as I have started working with farmers and their employees from Mexico, it is just such an incredibly perfect fit. The folks that come up from Mexico, they really want to work as many hours as possible because they are trying to create a better life for their family. So the more hours that they can get on a farm, the more money that they are able to send back to send their kids to school, to build houses for not only their families, but for their parents and anyone that they know might need it. And so it has become this relationship where the farmers benefit and the employees that are coming from Mexico benefit as well.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. First, let me remind you that you can find what we do over at upnorthnewswi.com. We have a team there working on stories every day. We're a separate entity from Civic Media, but we love being on the radio network and telling you what we're working on, and feel like you should listen to our friends at Civic Media throughout the day as well. You can find what we do on social media. Just head over to upnorthnewswi.com or upnorthnewswi on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of the socials. We'd love to put stories there throughout the course of the day, keep you up to speed on what's happening around Wisconsin. More of Up North News Radio in just a sec. Ruth, I really got an appreciation for something that I'd also seen when I was living in the Caribbean, that, yeah, there were some people from, you know, Jamaica that would come to Grand Cayman because that's where the jobs were, but there were so many people from the Philippines that were coming in and, again, working their hearts out. And they'd be at the service desk at the grocery store, you know, to Western Union and telegraph so much of the money back to Philippines with almost no expectation of when they might ever see that family again. And that was the part that really struck me from your book, was getting this appreciation that it's not like workers come up for, you know, a couple of months and then they go back for a couple of months, go back for a couple of months. It's sometimes years without seeing their own kids.
Yeah. And that really doesn't have to be the case. That's because of U.S. immigration policy. You know, I think one thing that's really important to understand is that the United States does not provide any form of visa to make year-round work on farms legal. So, you know, that's fixable. It's legal to come up and follow crops on an H-2A visa and be here for a short time and then go back for a maximum of 9 months. You have to go back to your home country. If you're doing full-time year-round work, you're pretty much not legal. So, That doesn't line up with how dependent we are in this country on these workers. So in, you know, I mentioned the 80% number for Wisconsin dairy, but, you know, it's true in construction, it's true in food service, it's true in a lot of industries. We are depending on this sort of shadow labor force, and folks are stuck here because of the militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border. It's so expensive and dangerous to cross that people stay for a long time, first of all, to pay back all the money they spent getting over, And then because they don't know when they'll be able to go back and return. And so, you know, that's a matter of policy. And I think recognizing this labor force, recognizing how dependent we are on them, and allowing people to stay and to have a visa and an organized system, to just be recognizing something that is already an economic reality and has been for decades.
And again, something you will appreciate through the stories in the book is that, you know, we say, well, they just walk across the border and then they work their way up to Wisconsin. It's not even close to that simple. And the money that they have to pay to these, you know, these coyotes, these, you know, merchants of death in some cases, though, and then eventually that's money that has to be paid back. It's money that they can't be sent back home. And like you said, it's so unnecessary. John, as you started working with Mexican laborers, were you kind of in that? Did that experience match up with your expectations of, you know, that maybe you thought it was easier than it actually is for these folks to come across the border and work their way up to Wisconsin?
When I look back at what I knew when I first started this 25 years ago, I knew nothing. I knew about three words of Spanish. I didn't know anything about the culture. My perception of a Mexican was somebody sitting on a street corner and taking a nap with a sombrero on his head. And that has completely changed. They're now people that are just exactly like I am or I was, hardworking and wanting to better their families. I've met their parents. I've met their wives in Mexico, and I've eaten at their table. I've slept in their beds in Mexico, and I've learned so much. And when we give talks and stuff about this, people ask, "What can we do? What can we do?" And since there's such a huge political divide, what I'm telling people to do is get to know an immigrant and get to know them by their first name. And if you do that, you're going to get rid of a lot of fear.
It is, because, again, you don't necessarily have to travel the world, although it helps, but you can just meet other people who are already here. So, John, when we talk about the trips that you make, and other farmers have made down to Mexico, it's because you can. You can get across the border and you can go meet their families. You're not usually bringing the workers. The workers are back on the farm, but you're going down and meeting their families in Mexico. And that has been, again, just a humanizing experience for an otherwise, you know, very much unhumanized issue in Washington.
It had such an impact. The first time we met Roberto Montalvo's family. They came down the mountains a couple hours to Orizaba, where we were staying, and met us. And it was such a big deal in Mexico. I was really surprised at that. But one of the journalists that was covering this story, and there were TV cameras and everything else following us, and asked him, what's the big deal? And he says, well, as far as he knew, that was the first time farmers or employers had come to Mexico to visit the families of their employees, which when you think about it, is kind of absurd. If you're going to be a good employer, you have to know your employees. You have to know their wants and needs. So how are you going to do that if you don't get involved? And I've learned a lot.
And without a doubt. And so we are going to continue this conversation after the break with John Rosenau from Wamandi, Mercedes Falk from Puentes Bridges. Ruth Conniff is the author of Milktown American Crisis, brought together Midwestern dairy farmers and Mexican workers. We'll continue that next. You're Up North.
Follow Up North News with our daily newsletter. Go to our website, upnorthnewswi.com, and click newsletter on the top banner. Once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
Checking the mailbag real quick here from Eric. I appreciate this story talking about our current segment here. I have shared revenue on the brain as the legislature discusses a state budget and shared revenue with local units of government. So I am wondering about the tax implications of migrant workers in Wisconsin. Do you have anything to say about that? Well, I guess with that, I'm going to turn things over back over to Ruth Conniff, which Honestly, for such the legislative nerd that I am, I hadn't actually thought about that. I was going to ask you about the driver's license issue, and we'll get to that in about two shakes here. But I guess first from the question, are there state budget implications or shared revenue implications? All I can think of is the many ways that legislators talk about addressing the labor shortage, and very, 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 very few of them on the Republican side mention maybe helping reform immigration.
Well, right. I mean, the Republicans are running against immigrants. Unfortunately, it just seems like it's going to be a huge issue through 2024, sort of fear-mongering about immigration and ignoring the fact that we are absolutely dependent on this immigrant labor force. And as far as taxes go, you know, if you are an undocumented immigrant and you are using a fake Social Security number to work in this country, as many people are, then there's withholdings that are going into our Social Security system. You're never going to realize any of those benefits. And so one of the very little remarked aspects of undocumented labor in the United States is that there's a whole lot of Social Security taxes being collected from people who are working here who are not drawing out of the system. So people are paying taxes because they're being withheld, but they're being withheld into an account for a fake name.
Yeah, it is, again, one of those things where people said, if you were to wave a magic wand and all the undocumented immigrants went away tomorrow, not only would you not be getting a lot of food or dairy products, but a whole lot of what's helping prop up, you know, your retirement accounts would be gone as well. But first, we're going to give you this reminder that you are listening back to a conversation that we held in May here on Up North News Radio. Ruth Conniff wrote the book Milked about this subject, and when we come back, we'll turn our attention to driver's licenses, something that was taken away from migrant laborers in Wisconsin. That was a big mistake. We'll tell you why and what needs to change in just a moment. You're up north. Let's do the driver's license issue. Mercedes, let me start with you just to talk about the importance of why people, even if they're undocumented, what's the importance of driver's licenses or permit car, however you want to say it, so that there is some form of accountability and safety on the roads? What's the importance of talking about that issue?
Oh my goodness, it is so incredibly important. So folks that are working, especially on dairy farms and places in other rural areas, they have to be able to bring their kids to school. If they have children here, they have to be able to get groceries, go to the doctors, very basic human needs. And right now, there is not a way for them to legally get a license to, one, be able to learn the rules of our road through a former program and make sure that it's safe. And two, just to have the basic human dignity to be able to drive to get what they need without fear of being pulled over.
John, is that an issue that, again, you've had either firsthand experience with or have watched other farms and farm families have to, go through this matter of whether their laborers can drive and get their family to places?
Yes, over the years, it's just, it's so absurd. The federal government provides a number for people that don't have documents called an ITIN number, so they can pay taxes. So they've made that mainstream so that they can collect taxes. But then on the state level, we're not allowing people to drive. And if you live out here in rural Wisconsin, you can't call Uber or grab a taxi or grab a bus. And you do have to eat and you do have to go buy food. So what is somebody going to do? They're going to drive. And if they would have to get a license, they would learn the safety things of the road. It makes absolutely no sense. You'd get more money. The state would get more money if they did the taxes, and the insurance companies would do better. It just, like a lot of things with immigration, it makes absolutely no sense.
for those folks watching the video feed, none of you heard John's answer. We're watching the adorable furball that that he's got in his lap here right now, who is clearly a big fan. John, the political angle of this, not the issue, but overall the farmers, we hear all the time about how rural Wisconsin is a fairly, deep red district, very Republican in nature with the voters. And Ruth, really lays out in the book that there are still, you would think, some people would think, oh, anybody that's had to work, with Mexican laborers and understands the issue, well, they must be, Democratic voting or Democratic supporters. That's not the case at all. There are still plenty of farmers who have, undocumented immigrants working there and still support either Donald Trump or support Republicans overall. And there's reasons for that, right? I mean, it's kind of a baseline political philosophy that is almost separate from immigration.
Most of my peers out here are Republicans. And so when we put up signs for Democrats or liberal issues and stuff on our yard, we're kind of by ourselves. But I think a lot of that has to do with history. A lot of people are conservative by nature and have grown up that way. I know my family goes back I think four generations, and then before we became Democrats, and that was in the Roosevelt era. And but there are other people that didn't, and they hold on to that. So it's really hard to make that change. In the dairy industry, there seems to be a real common theme that everybody understands the immigration issue. They understand what needs to be done. And they're very supportive of it, even if they are on a different party.
Yeah. And Ruth, from a political, for all the coverage that you give of issues, with the Wisconsin Examiner and such, that you understand that on there's several issues, immigration's only one of them, where rank and file Republican leaning voters, whether it's immigration or gun safety or abortion rights, they are actually closer to the mainstream than the people that they're voting for. And would almost welcome if their chosen party came back from its fringes and became more of a center right party.
I mean, I think, people are complicated. And I would say writing this book really made me see that. I mean, I live in liberal Madison, Wisconsin. So going to, talk to folks in rural Wisconsin who voted for Trump twice, and, it's a big part of the reason that Trump one office in 2016, you see something on the ground level that is not evident at 30,000 feet, which is that, people have a lot of different things going on in their lives. And just because they are Republicans and Trump voters doesn't mean that they can't also make a deep connection with undocumented immigrant workers who they are working with side by side. These are two groups of rural people who are under pressure from global economic forces beyond their control. And so a lot of the things that farmers talk about, who I interviewed when they talk about why they supported Trump, was that they felt abandoned by both political parties. They felt that global trade deals like NAFTA had been terrible for them. When Trump talked about remembering the forgotten men and women of America and throwing a rock at the system, they thought, great. there's a sense of abandonment and alienation. And when I talk about my book to East and West Coast audiences, often I get this question about whether farmers have seen the errors of their ways and are now going to start watching MSNBC basically and voting for Democrats. And it's just not that simple. I think, people have to understand that, Democrats need to understand they need to go to rural areas, meet rural people and address rural issues if they want to get rural votes. So that's I think an important part of the story too.
Mercedes, from the standpoint of the laborers, and they obviously have a lot of focus on working and supporting their families, but again, because of the whole nature of what Trump has done to politics, but even pre-Trump, with the Republican Party stances, do a lot of folks, do they feel like they're in hostile territory, or are they fairly jaded to politics? I mean, it's certainly not as if politics in Mexico is squeaky clean itself.
It depends, just like anyone, on the perspective of the person. And I would say people have a very similar viewpoint on talking about politics as we do here in rural areas. If you're not sure, if somebody thinks the same as you, you just don't talk about it. And I think, obviously, during the election of Trump back in 2017, it was pretty difficult and people were afraid. But then when they realized that there wasn't going to be an action taken on them being able to continue to live and work here, then it just kind of faded in the background. And I think that's kind of the main viewpoint here, is we just continue to do our work, we focus on ourselves and kind of let politics take place in the background. And I think, as Ruth had mentioned, as people get to know each other on this more profound level, then they realize, if they have different viewpoints about politics, that you just don't breach that subject and you continue to focus on what you do have in common.
And so this takes us to our last question, and that is where we go from here. And both Ruth in the book and also at Up North News, we've used the example of Arcadia, of a place where undocumented immigrants came in to be laborers in one area, have stayed, have put down roots, and are now entrepreneurs. They have their own, you know, small businesses. And at times that has created some local tension, but in other ways it has been the next step in progress that immigrants have seen for a couple hundred years here. John, from the standpoint of, you know, who's going to take over these farms? Do you foresee an eventual path where some of your Mexican workers will become the owners of Wisconsin farms someday?
It's a logical occurrence. Here are people that really like what they're doing. They would, they've had success. They know what to do. It's logical for them to take over the farm. And I would love that to happen here. I would love it to be able to turn the farm over to my Mexican employees. And but the legality issue is still there. And there's probably ways around it, like there's ways around everything. And but the logical thing would be for the next generation of farmers in Wisconsin to be Mexican.
It sure would. And Ruth, I don't mean to end on a down note, but if this doesn't get fixed, I fear it goes the other way, that these farms just become mega corporate owned and these corporations continue to have undocumented labor, because that's the easiest thing for a corporation to do. So, I mean, there's a real contrast in how this issue could go, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all becoming aware with recent reporting about child labor, forced labor of Central American children for some of the biggest brand name companies in the United States, that we're dependent on this shadow workforce in a way that's creepy. Here in Wisconsin, we're really a different place with that, because we have had this small farm history. And my book is about relationships among, you know, farmers and workers who are really working side by side, and their recognition of their common humanity and how much we're all in the same boat. And I think that's a really hopeful story. And so we really need to think about what we want to have happen, what kind of world we want to live in, and how we want people to be treated.
Yeah.
We can really go either way.
Without a doubt. The book is called Milked. Ruth Conniff is the author. And I, again, can't recommend it highly enough. And Ruth, I can't thank you enough for writing it. And John Rosenau and Mercedes Falk, thank you so much for being with us this morning as well. So that was our conversation in May. And at the time, we thought very little else was likely to happen, especially in Congress, where no serious immigration has been done since Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill worked out a landmark deal in 1986. That wasn't supposed to be the final word. There was supposed to be, every few years, some incremental changes and adjustments to account for the needs of the workforce, or amnesty rules because of conflicts around the world, whatever the case may be. But very little has transpired at the federal level. Now, more recently, at the state level, there's been activity, at least for one group of migrants, these particular migrants were children when they came across the border. Their parents were undocumented immigrants. They brought their children with them at great personal risk. And those who made it, those who settled down, those children have never known any home but the United States. They've gone to schools. Some of them have grown and taken on jobs. Some have gone to college, have started careers, but they have faced roadblocks because they themselves are undocumented. And a nickname was given to them, Dreamers. And there was a program called DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that applied to a certain group so that it wasn't a blank check. It wasn't open-ended, but to a particular group of undocumented immigrants who came over as children, of allowing them to, if not have a path to citizenship, at least have an easier path into the workforce where they didn't face deportation to a country that they had never known. Well, at the state level now, more is being done for recipients of DACA. These are people who have to be vetted. They have to keep a clean police record. And as a result, there's now a move in Wisconsin as well from both Republican and Democratic legislators to make it easier for DACA recipients to get professional licenses, maybe even be able to access in-state tuition. And so we talked to Tony Gonzalez from the American Business Immigration Coalition. We talked to him on December 6th about the proposals that are out there and the improvements it could make. Obviously, a lot more needs to be done, but any kind of improvement in this situation could be good for the Wisconsin economy. And we'll hear that conversation with Tony Gonzalez coming up next on Up North News Radio. Republican legislators that could lead to professional licenses and in-state tuition for a subset of immigrants in Wisconsin. These are folks known as Dreamers. They are DACA recipients. DACA is a federal program called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. These are the children of undocumented immigrants who arrive during a certain period in time. And the United States is the only country they've ever known. In many cases, Wisconsin is the only home they've ever known. They have been caught up in a lengthy immigration fight in Washington, D.C., which is still going on to this day. But other states are doing more to allow these Dreamers, this subset, to receive things like professional licenses. Tony Gonzalez has been working on that issue for years, talking to legislators. He's visited with us before and joins us again this morning. Tony, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Pat. Very good. I feeling very good this morning. A lot of positive things happening, you know, besides all the bad stories that we hear every day from all around the world.
It's interesting because these proposals coming from Republican lawmakers, these are not too far off of what Governor Tony Evers has proposed, and he included them in his last budget bill. As we know, Republican legislators stripped out many of Evers' initiatives in the budget bill, and we had no idea if any of them would come back as separate bills. Now these are... How did you find out about this? What was your role in helping these Republican legislators see the wisdom of putting these into separate legislation?
Thank you. And first I'll say, you know, that these bills right now are actually bipartisan bills. You know, we have co-sponsors like Senator Lena Taylor from Milwaukee and Representative Sylvia Ortiz-Velez, also from the Milwaukee area. And I believe also... Representative Evan Goyke, and they're right now we have the principal on it that started it. This was Representative John Mako, yes, a Republican, and Joel Kitchens is in it right now. So this really started some months ago, back in a little bit before April, with a bill that was introduced to get DACA students to be able to join law enforcement in Wisconsin. And we have had great support with that from the police organizations and from the faith community and all that. We're a little short on that. You know, we're hoping for a couple more votes, and maybe this momentum right now with these three bills will bring that bill to the line, you know, to the goal line. So, you know, these bills, like you were saying correctly, you know, we've been kind of aware of them coming up sometime. And finally, you know, this week, they were announced on a press conference down in Madison. We expected it to come, but not as quick. We were hoping for the other bill to get through first. But being that, you know, the session will end in March or something, they got presented. Now, yeah, like you were saying, some of these were part of the governor's budget. But, you know, the inside fighting with Republicans and Democrats, you know, things weren't going to happen right there. But there was some expressed interest that these bills could come up as separate bills on their own. And, you know, we're seeing that happen right now. So we're hoping to get all the support that we have already gathered thus far and bring these three bills to the finish line. You know, I mean, they're very important. They're good and primarily for those individuals that have DACA and definitely for our state economy.
Yeah, the bills would allow DACA recipients to seek professional licenses and things like engineering and the building trades, nursing, teaching. Another bill would grant in-state tuition status to Wisconsin colleges. There's one that would lead to a tax credit for the fees that are incurred with renewing DACA status every couple of years. An article from Wisconsin Public Radio notes that about two dozen other states offer in-state tuition to DACA recipients. And so really, Tony, this sounds to me, and I didn't mean to take away from the Democratic legislators who are supporting this, that comes naturally, but that, you know, members of the Republican majority are also behind it is what seems to give it this big push. And the impression I get is that they are seeing everything that I just read off about the bills, that this is really about other states are competing with them from a labor, from a workforce standpoint, and that Wisconsin doesn't want to fall behind.
Oh, absolutely. Even, you know, as we were talking, you know, about the in-state tuition issue, you know, that Wisconsin since 2011 took it out. Funny enough, we have a reciprocal deal with Minnesota University, too. So if you are a DACA recipient that lives in Wisconsin, but you go to University of Minnesota, you get in-state tuition. So, you know, this is an easy way for people to, you know, say, you know what, I'm done with Wisconsin. I'm going on to the next state. I'm going down to Illinois. And we're losing all that talent that should be here, that considers Wisconsin home. They have their families here. And, you know, like I was saying yesterday, we have there's about 200,000 open jobs in the state of Wisconsin with a 2.5 unemployment rate. That makes probably availability at 77,000 people. There's a huge gap to fill. We got 6,500 DACA individuals that are very qualified, that are very well vetted, ready to work, have gone to school already. Why not tap into this? And, you know, that was the word on Monday at the press conference, you know, an acknowledgement of that let government get out the way and let these individuals work and hope that the federal government one day gets on their wheels and does something for all these individuals.
That's right. And again, this is a finite group in the sense that these applicants had to have arrived in the U.S. before age 16 and have lived here since June 15th of 2007. They have to renew that status every 2 years. They have to maintain a clean criminal record, receive regular background checks. But while that is a rather finite group of people who came here, you know, undocumented when their parents came, these are people who are now having children of their own. They're now of that age. And so this is an opportunity to, again, take at least one group of people who are, you know, often Mexican-American or Central American and put them on a path that has been so elusive for so long.
Oh, absolutely. You know, as you were saying, the numbers right now show that there is at least 250,000 sons and daughters of DACA recipients. And that's in an early stage because these people are still very young. So, you know, that number will do nothing but increase. And, you know, they become a very important block. And we have to think in the future, we and not only that, humanitarily, we got to think, like you were saying at the beginning of the program, these are individuals that have known nothing else but the United States as their country. If you see them, they act, they're just around your neighborhood. You probably know one or two and not even know they're DACA, and they're ready to get going here.
That's Tony Gonzalez, and that's all the time we have for Up North News Radio for today. Thank you for helping us listen back to some great guests on important rural Wisconsin topics in 2023. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Have a great day.